and reading this evening in chapter 4. May I just mention that there is available tonight an address on Moses, man of God, from Hebrews 11, that famous passage that I gave at a convention quite some time ago. I thought it might be useful to make copies of it. There are enough, I think, for everybody, and will be available at the end and will be handed out as you go. You're very welcome to take one. Now, let's read the whole chapter through, because we want to get the whole flavor of this remarkable passage. And Moses answered and said, and we break in here to the discussion that Moses is having with the Lord. And Moses answered and said, but behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, the Lord hath not appeared unto thee. And the Lord said unto him, what is that in thine hand? And he said, a rod. And he said, cast it on the ground. And he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from before it. And the Lord said unto Moses, put forth thine hand, and take it by the tail. And he put forth his hand, and caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath appeared unto thee. I have done this, we need to understand, that they may believe. And the Lord said furthermore unto him, put now thine hand into thy bosom. And he put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous as snow. And he said, put thine hand into thy bosom again. And he put his hand into his bosom again, and plucked it out of his bosom, and behold, it was turned again as his other flesh. And it shall come to pass, if they will not believe thee, neither hearken to the voice of the first sign, that they will believe the voice of the latter sign. And it shall come to pass, if they will not believe also these two signs, neither hearken unto thy voice, that thou shalt take of the water of the river and pour it upon the dry land. And the water which thou takest out of the river shall become blood upon the dry land. And Moses said unto the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. And the Lord said unto him, who hath made man's mouth? Or who maketh the dumb or deaf or the seeing or the blind? Have not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with thy mouth, and teach thee what thou shalt say. And he said, O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he can speak well. And also, behold, he cometh forth to meet thee, and when he seeth thee, he will be glad in his heart, and thou shalt speak unto him, and put words in his mouth, and I will be with thy mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you what ye shall do. And he shall be thy spokesman unto the people, and he shall be even as he shall be to thee instead of a mouth, and thou shalt be to him instead of God. And thou shalt take this rod in thine hand, wherewith thou shalt do signs. And Moses went and returned to Jethro his father-in-law, and said unto him, let me go, I pray thee, and return unto my brethren which are in Egypt, and see whether they be yet alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. And the Lord said unto Moses in Midian, go, return into Egypt, for all the men that are dead that who sought thy life. And Moses took his wife and his sons, and set them upon an ass, and he returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God in his hand. And the Lord said unto Moses, when thou goest to return into Egypt, see that thou do all those wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in thine hand. But I will harden his heart, that he shall not let the people go. And thou shalt say unto Pharaoh, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. And I say unto thee, let my son go, that he may serve me. And if thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn. And it came to pass by the way in the inn that the Lord met Moses and sought to kill him. Then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at Moses' feet and said, "Surely a bloody husband art thou to me." So he, that is God, let him go, Moses. Then she said, "A bloody husband thou art because of the circumcision." And the Lord said to Aaron, "Go into the wilderness to meet Moses." And he went and met him in the mount of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord who had sent him, and all the signs which he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spake all the words which the Lord had spoken unto Moses, and did the signs in the sight of the people, and the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel, and that he had looked upon their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshipped. Now, there's a great deal, as you can see, in that chapter. In the past 3 weeks, we have concentrated on one chapter per evening, since, of course, these opening chapters have particular significance and merit this detailed treatment. And this also applies to chapter 4, which we're going to look at in detail tonight. And then after this, in subsequent Bible readings, we'll be able to take longer sections, as, for example, the next section, chapters 5 to 11, which deal with the one subject of the ongoing contest with Pharaoh. And we can deal with that more summarily. But tonight, chapter 4 is a very important one because it deals with Moses' commissioning by God. And as I said when we began the reading, we break into the argument that Moses entered into with the Lord. And an argument which began, you remember, in chapter 3. Look back to verse 11. Moses said unto God, after God had said, "Come now, I will send thee unto Pharaoh. Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh?" And God gave him the assurance, "Certainly I will be with thee." Verse 13, Moses said to God, "Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, 'The God of your fathers hath sent me unto you,' and they shall say unto me, 'What is his name?' What shall I say unto them?" So on and so forth. And then in verse 18, God said to him, "They shall hearken to thy voice, the people, and thou shalt come, thou and the elders of Israel, unto the king of Egypt." And Moses said, "But behold," chapter 4, verse 1, "they will not believe me, nor hearken to my voice." Now it's when you put these verses together that you see the enormity of what Moses is doing here. God has just said, "They shall hearken to thy voice, Moses." And Moses says to the Lord God Almighty, "Lord, you're wrong, you know. They won't hearken to my voice." That's the context in which this discussion is going on. And we see again and again, verse 10, "O my Lord, I am not eloquent, I am slow of speech." And God is still very patient. And then in verse 13, he said, "O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send." And Moses saw that the Lord's anger was kindled against him. Now, let's look at this first sign, the sign of the rod. We can understand, in a sense, Moses' statement in verse 4, although we shrink from that kind of response to God's clear word in verse 18 of chapter 3, we can understand it, and it may well be that this refers back to the reaction that his people showed in chapter 2, 40 years back, when he tried to be their champion. Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? They said. In other words, Moses recalls his failure and ineffectiveness in the past, and pleads that with God as an excuse or a reason for not going forward now in his name. And it's that that is answered by this miraculous sign of the rod, which turns into a serpent and then turns back again to its original form. And what God is saying in effect to Moses is this. Yes, Moses, you have natural qualities and gifts of leadership, but gifts and qualities unsanctified and undirected and uncontrolled by me can be tragic and will run amok and turn again and rend you. Isn't that what happened yon time, Moses, when you slew the Egyptian and when you intervened in the quarrel between the two Hebrews? Yes, Moses, you flee from this serpent just as you fled these years ago in disorder, because you were not in my control. Now, says God, take up the serpent by the tail in faith and in obedience to my word. And he did, and it became a rod again, henceforth called the rod of God, the sign and seal of God's commission and authority. So, Moses, take up the work from which you fled these years ago in disorder, and do it my way, under my direction, and then they will hear you. Now, there are a number of scriptural parallels to this idea. I was recalling this afternoon how it was, for example, with Samson, a man of undoubted gifts and abilities, with great potential for leadership, but so substantially he was out of control. He did it his way, and there was no discipline in his life, and it finally led to disaster and tragedy. And it was only when Samson was prepared to do it God's way that he really prevailed. Take the story as another illustration of the Apostle Peter in that post-resurrection incident, when Peter, by the Sea of Galilee, blurted out suddenly, "I go fishing." And the others followed suit, and they went out on their boats and fished all night and caught nothing. And in the morning, Christ instructed them, told them where to cast the net, and they caught more than they were able to draw to the shore. Christ directed service, you see, is the only service that bears fruit. Now, this parable of the rod that became a serpent and was, when picked up, was turned into a rod of authority, it speaks some very practical and very important lessons for the spiritual life. It speaks of experiences common to us all, of barrenness in the service of God, of right things done, it may be, in the wrong way, of right things done at the wrong time, of going when we're not bidden, of zeal without knowledge. All this was true of Moses. And the message is clear. God says, when I take you up, men will listen to you and will know that the living God has met with you. Now, let's try to draw out some of these lessons. F.B. Meyer, in his very valuable book on Exodus and on this part of the story of Moses, puts it this way, referring to what is that in thine hand, when God asks, what is that in thy hand? There's always something, he says, in our hand. Every life has some capacity. God says to each of us, what is that in thine hand? He takes it for granted that there is something there. Do not envy each other or despise one another. For if you do, you will paralyze your personal capacity and threaten your life with failure. To every one of us is given grace according to the measure of the gift of God. And perhaps the hardest lesson that anyone can learn is to believe that every gift from heaven is of equal intrinsic worth. Our success is to be measured not by the character of the capacity, but its realization and its full use. Well, you see, in every one of us there is a potential, either for good or evil. And if we're going to be any use to God, our all, as we say, must be upon the altar. And we must present our bodies a living sacrifice to God. We, so to speak, are the raw material. And it depends what use we're going to make of ourselves, whether we shall be a blessing or a hazard to those with whom we come in contact and among whom we live. Let loose, you see, the natural man, without the restraint and control of the Spirit of God, can be a very serpent, biting and stinging and ruinous to life and soul, our own life and others. We've often seen in history men with tremendous gifts and qualities, but they've got out of control, and they've done immense injury and harm to mankind. Lives with great possibilities, but whose instincts, impulses, are allowed to run amok. Instead of useful lives, we see moral shipwrecks. That's what we need to learn from this kind of story. What is that in thine hand? And what it tells us is this. It is a message for all ages, but perhaps it may be particularly a message for younger people at the outset of Christian life and service. And it says this. And especially in relation to Moses' earlier exploits. Hand over your life to God. Lay firm hold upon it through grace, and it will no longer be a terrific problem to you, bewildering you, frightening you, terrifying you with the powers that rage within it. But it will become what it was meant to be, a life harnessed to the will of God, an instrument of righteousness, carrying power and authority. Left to itself, it becomes like a serpent from which we flee in terror. Taken up at the behest of God, it becomes an authority for Him. Another lesson here, you see, is that spiritual and fleshly service don't mix. And when they accompany one another in Christian life, they lead to confusion and endless trouble. Spiritual service mixed with the flesh. Spiritual service with mixed motives can have very grave repercussions. so often service is tainted with fleshly, carnal concerns. Well, he that soweth to the flesh, as Paul puts it, shall of the flesh reap corruption. Look at the story of Abraham. And this is one of the things we learn from these earlier books of the Bible. Abraham was given a promise by God. Isaac was the spiritual seed, promised of God. But Abraham, in fleshly impatience, couldn't wait for God and must produce a fleshly seed called Ishmael. And God said, Abraham, you've made your bed, now you must lie on it. And down the long centuries, the seed of Ishmael, the fleshly seed, has proved to be a thorn in the flesh to Abraham's promised seed, and are to this day the hereditary enemies of the people of God. All Arabs claim descent from Ishmael. And this is one of the most graphic and indeed dramatic historical phenomena. The animosity, the hatred between Arabs and Jews has persisted down the centuries. And that is its origin. What is that in thine hand? And he said, a rod. Cast it on the ground. And he cast it on the ground and it became a serpent. That's a very solemn and indeed solemnizing lesson. But there are more encouraging lessons than that here, and one is this has something to say about our personal and one might almost say psychological makeup. Suppose we are saddled with a real fundamental twist or weakness of temperament. We're all frail creatures, of course, but sometimes there are special weaknesses or dispositions or tendencies. Now, these things by themselves are not sin, but often they can lead us into sin. Somebody who has a constitutionally unstable emotional makeup faces inevitable hazards in experience. It may be that they're more prone to quarrel or to lose temper or to have ruptures in relationships or even much worse. And when these instabilities, constitutional instabilities, gain the upper hand, they can have, as we well know, ruinous repercussions. Now, there are two ways of reacting to them. We can give in to them and give them rein and plead, I can't help it, it's how I'm made. In which case they will play havoc with our lives. But there's another way, and it's along the line of this parable. Take it up in the name of God. Take the serpent by the tail, and it will become an instrument of power in your hand. It can become the very thing in your life and experience that God will use for his glory. I have known men like that. for whom the potential for disaster has been very great and often very critical. But in their weakness and in their anguish, they've cast themselves upon God, and they've taken up this weakness in the name of God, and it's become the very thing that enables God to use them for His glory. And one of the things that we sometimes learn in spiritual life is that men who are greatly used of God are used not because they're strong, but often because they're very weak. And in their weakness, they cast themselves helplessly upon God. And God takes them up. And out of weakness, they're made strong. Think, for example, of a particular instance of this. Paul's thorn in the flesh. Now, we don't know what that was. And I think we're not meant to know, for the very reason that we can identify all kinds of thorns in the flesh. It wasn't a besetting sin, because God delivers us from besetting sins, but it was some constitutional problem, let us say, for which there was no healing, although God besought the Lord thrice to remove the thing. But God said, "My grace is sufficient for thee." And that thorn in the flesh of Paul brought the power of the cross into his life in a remarkable way. "Most gladly will I glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ might rest upon me." What is that in thine hand? Lord, you know this weakness. By itself, it can tyrannize. "Take it up for me," says God. And in God's hands, it becomes the symbol of authority. Now, when we studied this on a previous occasion, we took the trouble to look up some reference. Let me just refer to them briefly. Because this rod of God was something that Moses carried with him all the way through his experience. It was the rod of God that wrought mighty deliverance from Pharaoh. The rod was the symbol of their being set free. It was the rod of God with which Moses parted the waters of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went through on dry land. It was the rod of God with which he smote the rock in the wilderness to quench the thirst of a weary people and brought forth rivers of living water. It was the rod of God that Moses held up at Rephidim when Amalek came and attacked Israel. And it wasn't the warrior band down in the plain under the command of Joshua, but it was the man of God on the mount holding up the rod of God that won the day. Now you see, that's the kind of picture that we have in this marvelous story. That's the symbol. And that was God's word to this hesitant and reluctant man. Verse 6 says, "The Lord said furthermore unto him, Put now thine hand into thy bosom. And he put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, it was leprous as snow. Put thine hand in thy bosom again. And he put his hand into his bosom again and plucked it out of his bosom." Now, it seems to me that the symbolism there is this. God was telling Moses in parabolic way that if he was going to be of any use to God, he needed to be cleansed. And that makes a lot of sense in relation to Moses' performance in this debate, because he was withdrawing from God, saying, "Oh God, don't send me, don't send me. I'm not your man." He was reacting against the call. He was unclean. And some commentators make the suggestion that this may well be the scripture passage that the psalmist David may have had in his mind when he wrote in Psalm 24, "Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord? He that hath clean hands and a pure heart. Put thine hand into thy bosom." And when he took it out, it was leprous. "Put your hand on your heart, Moses, and then look and see what it's like. You need cleansing." That, it seems to me, is the significance of that second parable and sign. Verse 9 says, "It shall come to pass, if they will not believe also these two signs, the rod and the cleansing hand, neither hearken unto thy voice, that thou shalt take of the water of the river and pour it upon the dry land, and the water which thou takest out of the river shall become blood upon the dry land." And this we see in the subsequent chapters, and we can leave that at the moment. Then in verse 10, the ongoing discussion, when Moses showed even more clearly his reluctance. And Moses said unto the Lord, "O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore, nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant. But I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue." That, as we pointed out last week, in spite of what Stephen says in Acts chapter 7, that Moses was a man mighty in words and deeds. That was Moses, mighty in words as well as deeds. "O my Lord, I am not eloquent. I am not eloquent." Now, it becomes clear at this point that what is happening is that Moses is shifting his ground as the Lord deals with every objection that he makes. And he just expresses an unwillingness. And God is revealing to Moses the real truth about himself in relation to these excuses he was making and the hesitation he was showing. God, in effect, is saying, "The real trouble with you, Moses, is that you have an evil heart of unbelief. And that's why you're moving from one objection to another." And the Lord very patiently says in verse 11, "Who hath made man's mouth? Or who maketh the dumb or deaf or the seeing or the blind? Have not I, the Lord?" As if to say, "Moses, you're on shaky ground here. I am the one who puts words in men's lips and mouths." And if you bear in mind what God had commanded him to go to Pharaoh to say, "Go to Pharaoh and say to him, let my people go." Now, you don't have to be terribly eloquent to say that, do you? "Let my people go." See, there's something very profound there. Paul speaks of the servants of the gospel as being ambassadors for Christ. An ambassador is one who hands over to the government to whom he is sent the message from his own government as it has been given to him. He's just a messenger. He doesn't require eloquence. What he requires is faithfulness to his remit. God had said, go to Pharaoh and say, let my people go. Let my people go. That's all. You don't need to be eloquent to say that kind of thing. There's a givenness about the Lord's message. And then Moses says, and in spite of what God says in verse 12, therefore go, and I will be with thy mouth, and teach thee what thou shalt say. And Moses said, O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send. Now that can be taken in two possible ways. Either Moses saying, O Lord, send someone else. Or, and this is perhaps a little less unflattering to Moses, but not much, I go because I must. I greatly question thy choice, but if there is no alternative, be it so. And either of these possible interpretations would surely have been sufficient to kindle the anger of the Lord. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And he said, is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he can speak well. And also, behold, he cometh forth to meet thee. And when he seeth thee, he will be glad in his heart. And thou shalt speak unto him, and put his words in his mouth. And I will be with thy mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you what ye shall do. And he shall be thy spokesman unto the people. And he shall be to thee instead of a mouth. And thou shalt be to him instead of God. And thou shalt take this rod in thine hand, wherewith thou shalt do signs. Now, it does seem to me that something solemn took place at this point, and I find a number of commentators general agreement with this idea. I have a little book at home entitled Men Who Prayed, written by a man called Frost, who at one time was a director of the OMF, or this old CIM. It goes through the Old Testament dealing with the prayers of God's people. And he mentions this discussion between God and Moses. He says, it's a bad thing for a man to answer back to God. He usually gets the worst of the argument. God had been wonderfully gracious to Moses, teaching him patiently and fully, and it should have been enough. But Moses was a man through and through, with all the frailty this implies. It was thus, while he was in the process of learning, that he dared to argue with God. And Moses answered and said, but, oh, these buts, beware of them. They are exceedingly foolish to begin with when God has once spoken, and besides, they are ruinous in their effect. And more in that vein. And then this. It is strange the undue value the natural man puts upon eloquence. From the natural standpoint, of course, there is reason for this, for the big talkers are usually the ones who catch the ear of the multitudes. But anyone who knows the ways of God ought not to make such a mistake. When has God put a premium upon eloquence? There is no reason to suppose that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were eloquent talkers. Yet God accomplished mighty things through them. And so with later saints such as Joshua, Caleb, and Samuel. Possibly David and Solomon were eloquent, but this was not the source of their power. And as for the apostles and Paul, who were used of God most of all, we know that they deliberately set their faces against oratorical effect and effort. But these were lessons Moses had not yet learned. And so we find him talking with God about his being slow of speech and of a slow tongue. God might have told him that such characteristics were much to be desired. But he takes another line of argument with him. Who hath made man's mouth? Or who made man dumb or deaf or the seeing or blind? Is it not I, Jehovah? Then he adds, Now therefore, go, and I will be with thy mouth and teach thee what thou shalt speak. The worshipper at the burning bush lost a blessing that day. He refused to count upon God's power, and the result was that God's anger was kindled against him. So Jehovah gave to Aaron the ministry which he purposed to give to Moses. It is a serious thing to trifle with God's grace and power. To do so is to run the risk of losing something which one may ultimately greatly covet. F.B. Meyer says, Beware, if you will not step up to the opportunity which God offers, you will not only miss it, but you will live to see it filled by an inferior man to yourself, through whom you may have to suffer many sorrows. And here's another commentator who refers to an incident much later on in Exodus, chapter 32, at verse 21. Remember when Moses went up on the mount with God, and Aaron and the people made the golden calf. When he cried to Aaron in the bitterness of his soul, What did this people to thee that thou hast brought so great a sin upon them? Did he remember by whose unfaithfulness Aaron had been thrust into the office, the responsibilities of which he had betrayed? That's very solemn, isn't it? If you will not step up to the opportunity which God offers, you will not only miss it, but you will live to see it filled by an inferior man to yourself, through whom you may have to suffer many sorrows. This commentator goes on, It is the duty of every man to whom a special vocation presents itself to set opposite each other two considerations. Dare I undertake this task? Is a solemn question. But so is this. Dare I let this task go past me? Am I prepared for the responsibility of allowing it to drift into weaker hands? These are days when the Church of Christ is calling for the help of everyone capable of aiding her, and we ought to hear it said much more often that one is afraid not to teach in Sunday school, and another dares not refuse a proffered district, and a third fears to leave charitable tasks undone. To him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is a sin. And we hear too much about the terrible responsibility of working for God, but too little about the still graver responsibility of refusing to work for him when called. That's what's happening here. And that's a very solemn situation. And Moses went and returned to Jethro his father-in-law and said to him, Let me go, I pray thee, and return unto my brethren which are in Egypt, and see whether they be yet alive. And Jethro said to Moses, Go in peace. It has been suggested that perhaps one reason for Moses' reluctance was what would be said at home. if he went home to Zipporah and his father-in-law and said, I've got to go to Egypt, God wants me to go to Egypt. And of course we know that it's a common occurrence that when people tell their loved ones that God has called them for the ministry or the mission field, they may face a very pointed and even bitter reaction. And it must have been a great relief to Moses to get Jethro's reaction, go in peace. And Jethro's stature surely stands out here when he is prepared to let Moses and his daughter go. And then this strange thing in verse 19, and the Lord said to Moses in Midian, go, return into Egypt. Some commentators suggest that Moses may still have been hesitating and delaying even after all this contretemps, and that the Lord with some asperity said, come on Moses, get a move on, return to Egypt, for all the men are dead who sought thy life. There's nothing for you to fear now. In passing, we may notice the very striking similarity in the language in that verse to the language in the Christmas story in Matthew chapter 2. Listen in Matthew chapter 2, verse 20. Arise, take the young child and his mother, and go into the land of Israel, for they are dead which sought the young child's life. It would be tempting to deal with that tonight, but I just mention that in passing as something to think about. And Moses took his wife and his sons and set them upon an ass, and he returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God in his hand. And then notice verses 21 to 23. The Lord said unto Moses, when thou goest to return into Egypt, see that thou do all these wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in thine hand. But I will harden his heart, that he shall not let the people go. And thou shalt say unto Pharaoh, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. And I say unto thee, let my son go, that he may serve me. And if thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn. And it is perhaps significant that now that Moses is on the move, the Lord spoke with him all the way, telling him what was to happen in Egypt. Fruitful fellowship and converse with the Lord when you are in the Lord's way and the Lord's will. And that's something very comforting and reassuring, isn't it? But, verse 24, and this is a strange and perplexing incident. And I think we must understand that it took place at the beginning of the journey, and perhaps prior in time to these verses 21 to 23. It came to pass, by the way, in the inn, that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. Now, I've looked up several commentators on this one, and they all seem to suggest that this is to be interpreted in terms of a sudden, severe sickness that came upon Moses that looked like threatening his very life, and that they recognized the hand of God in it. Now, there's nothing in the text which says that, although the Greek version of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, says that the angel of the Lord met him. And the rabbis tended to interpret this in terms of a visitation of illness, which both Moses and Zipporah recognized as being from the Lord in terms of chastisement. And it's that that explains the otherwise perplexing and seemingly otherwise irrelevant reference to the circumcision of Moses' second son. Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at his feet. Now, there would be no point in referring to this act of circumcision at this particular point unless it had some kind of intrinsic connection with Moses having been struck down. And the commentators seem united in interpreting it in something like this way, that the sign of the covenant had been neglected in the case of one of Moses' sons, presumably the younger of the two, Eleazar. It may be that in the context of the Midianite situation, it had gone by default. They hadn't bothered to do it in an alien, as it were, environment. In much the same sort of way as Christian people might well, in an alien environment, tend to neglect some of the regular ordinances of God. Now, this was the covenant God who had revealed himself to Moses at the burning bush. The covenant name of Jehovah had been revealed, and what was being indicated to Moses was that he was now being involved in covenant work, and therefore to have neglected the covenant sign was something serious, and that they both recognized that this in fact was why Moses had been struck down. Some commentators suggest that it may well have become an issue in their home, and that Zipporah had opposed this, and for peace's sake Moses had yielded to her for against his better judgment. And that may be one of the factors, you see, underlying Moses' continuing reluctance as recorded in this chapter. And the question arises whether he had put peace in his home before the fulfillment of his high calling. Well, it never pays to do that, you know, because the issue at last has to be faced. And it's usually much more distressing and costly when it is faced after having been postponed for so long. And it does seem as if Zipporah and the children went back to Jethro at this point, and we learn later on, is it in chapter 18, that they returned to Moses after he had delivered the children of Israel from Egypt and had brought them through the Red Sea on the way to the Promised Land. And then, chapter 18, we're told that Zipporah and the two children rejoined Moses. But it looks as if they went back here, although we're not told. the phrase verse in 26, so he let him go, must refer to God. So God let him go. That is to say, the sickness departed from him. God let go his hand. If laying hold upon Moses brought seemingly mortal sickness upon him, then letting him go would correspondingly mean his cure. And then she said this. But it does seem as if the relationship between Moses and Zipporah had deteriorated. And one commentator points out that later on, when Moses' great triumph in bringing Israel through the Red Sea, it was Moses' sister, not his wife, who sang the song of triumph. And it was Moses' sister, not Zipporah, who figured so prominently in the ongoing march of the people of God. And then verse 27, and the Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. And he went and met him in the mount of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord who had sent him and all the signs which he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spake all the words. Notice. Aaron spake all the words. Not Moses. Aaron. Moses was displaced, you see. God means that we shall take him seriously on pain of punishment. Aaron spake all the words which the Lord had spoken unto Moses and did the signs in the sight of the people. Aaron did them, not Moses. Aaron. And the people believed. Verse 1 says, behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice. But when he actually obeyed, things clicked into place. And the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel, and that he had looked upon their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshipped. And from that point onwards, everything was according to plan. Now, don't you think it's very daring of God to expose all this to us? See, God is not afraid to show up the sins of the saints. God is very honest. But I think what we have to recognize is this, that this was the preparation time for Moses. And now, at last, he was ready. And from this point onwards, you see Moses, strong, purposeful, with one aim. To use Paul's words, this one thing I do. And isn't that an enormous encouragement for us lesser mortals? We may make many mistakes. We may have many stumblings. The Lord may be angry and displeased with us many times. Aye, and have to chastise us and bring us low many times before he gets us where he wants us. But you see, that's all with a purpose in view. That's God's strange work. I've often said there's something very ruthless about the divine love. And I believe that in the best sense of that term. But oh, don't let us forget that this is the man with whom God spoke face to face, as a man speaketh with his friend. And I believe Moses reckoned that all this travail was abundantly worthwhile in view of the fellowship into which he entered from this point onwards. And that's what we're going to see. But this is the preparation. And there's a very human note in it all. Our hesitance, our reluctance, our debate with the Lord. But Lord, but Lord, but Lord. And he's very patient with us, but we may not presume on that patience. You see, he is intent upon bringing the sentence of death upon us, that the life also of the living God might be manifest in our mortal flesh. That's the pattern. And God willing, we'll go on from there next week. Let us pray.